Although I've entitled this section Organ Donation Procurement Agencies, I've chosen an article for our collective reflection that discusses more than just the question of these agencies. But nevertheless, they are central to the discussion in the article, and I believe it's reasonable to let them be the focus around which our concerns will revolve. Let's begin, and again, you can see the references from this article. It's from the New England Journal of Medicine in 2008. I've given you a citation from another article that comes from 2007 that describes the nature of the issue involved in organ donation and the number of donors. Although the numbers of organ donors and transplantations in the U.S. have more than doubled over the past 20 years, the demand for organs continues to dwarf the supply. In 2006, there were about 29,000 solid organ transplantations. As of June 2007, there were about 97,000 people on waiting lists for organ transplantation. So there is an extremely large number of people who are waiting and a relatively smaller number of people who are available as organ donors. And as we'll see, one of the primary issues has to do with the fact that from 1968 until well into the first decade of the 21st century, the predominant approach to the question of organ donation was the requirement that the donor be brain dead. Again, we're not talking about live organ donations at this point. And as we'll see, that's not the case anymore. Let's look at number one. The important issue is raised. The number of organ donations needs to be increased. There needs to be strong encouragement to people to donate organs, but this needs to be done without sacrificing ethical integrity within the profession. And one might add that it's not just a question of integrity for those who are suspicious of the whole nature of ethics, but in fact it has to do with public opinion and how the public regards the question of being organ donors. If there is any kind of a fear that the health profession will hasten death or not respect the conditions that are required for a person to be an organ donor, then there will probably be a public outcry and the number of organs will be considerably fewer. So there is a kind of a consequentialist motive in regard to maintaining high ethical integrity in this area. So let's go ahead and glance at this first paragraph. It describes the fact that clinicians have an ethical obligation to help ensure that the desires of people who want to donate organs are respected, and highlighted in white a little further on, clinicians have an obligation to ensure that the consent process is informed and voluntary. And this is absolutely key, because rather overwhelmingly in the healthcare professions, there is the presumption, which we've seen is also shared by the Catholic Magisterium, that organ donation is a very good thing to do, that it is a positive moral, it has a positive moral value. This leads some to believe that as they have the high moral ground, their goal should be to convince others rather than to facilitate others in a process of making an informed choice. And this raises a very important question as to the fundamental value of informed consent. And highlighted in red is the issue that one physician noted. If you promote organ donation too much, people lose sight of the fact that it's a dying patient. It's not just a source of organs. It's a person. The donor is a human being whose integrity needs to be respected, whose wishes, especially if they wish to donate organs, should be respected. But what about the individual or the family that absolutely does not wish to donate organs? One may well regard them as not making the morally right choice, but does that grant the right to try to coerce or force the person to make another kind of decision? And as we'll see, that's one of the fundamental emphases or foci of this particular article. I should mention that the sections in white against a green background, the statements in white against a green background that I have numbered, are my own addition to the article. They are not found in the original. So here is an example of the author's concern about the kinds of issues that have arisen as a result of the desire to increase the availability of organs for donation. What happens if life-sustaining treatment is continued against patient wishes? And this This is a very real issue. As the paragraph notes, in 2006, there was a Commission on Uniform State Laws which worked with another agency to amend the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, which is one of the fundamental pieces of legislation that pertains to organ donation. And the amendment originally stipulated that physicians must continue life-sustaining treatment for dying patients until the local organ procurement organization, here in this article, this is abbreviated as OPO, another example of our trying to communicate everything via three-letter acronyms, but the organ procurement organization would be required to determine whether the patient's organs were suitable, even if the patient had an advance directive stating that they did not want such treatment. So here you have this problem of the conviction that that organ donation is such a moral good that it ought to override the patient's desire not to have continued life-sustaining treatment. Now, this was a proposal, and when critical care physicians became aware of it, as you can see highlighted in white, they voiced their ethical concerns, and then in 2007, the following year, there was an amendment that emphasized that the attending physician should consult the patient or surrogate as early as possible and follow the patient's wishes, even if doing so resulted in the loss of potentially transplantable organs. Here again, you can imagine that this was partly ethical and partly also political. There was a concern that suddenly, if this became known, that people's advance directives were going to be ignored so that they could be made into organ donors, this would have certainly provoked a very strong outcry in the population. So when it was realized that that would be the effect and that's how it would be seen, the effort was curbed. But notice that the moral impulse out of which it arises is the conviction that organ donation is such a moral good that it can be forced or coerced in such a way as to set aside the person's advance directives. Now, again, this didn't happen, but you can see that there was a very strong movement in favor of doing this, which had to be curbed later. Section number 3, and this has to do more specifically with the question of organ procurement organizations. Now, for those who are not familiar with this concept, there exist throughout the United States organizations which are manned to some extent they're manned entirely by trained professionals, but many of these are volunteers who make themselves available as the first contact person who will be the individual to discuss with the family or the individual if they're conscious, but generally speaking with the family or the decision maker for the individual, the designated proxy, the question of organ donation. The philosophy behind this is that these conversations, the question of organ donation, should be raised not by the attending physician, not by the people who are caring for the patient, but instead by these very specifically trained individuals who are not involved in patient care directly. In many ways, this is quite understandable and even laudable. One doesn't want there to be a conflict of interest, and the reality is that those who are caring for the life of the individual often find it extremely difficult to raise the question of organ donation. They find it rather painful, emotionally difficult, even repugnant in light of all that they've been doing to help the individual. Now, this is not universal, of course. There are many physicians who are very willing and even eager to raise this question in an appropriate way, but many find it hard. And so the availability of individuals from these organ procurement organizations can be a great aid to physicians in facilitating a discussion about on this subject. As an example, and each state has its own particular form, its own particular branches of these organizations. In Southern California, the organization that is most common is called One Legacy, and their website can be visited, and it is an interesting thing to do to see how they describe and promote the practice of organ donation. So, having said all of this, you'll notice in section number 3, and in the highlighted area, the organ procurement organizations are those who will ensure that the person who initiates the request of the family is a representative or a designated requester. Now, many institutions carry this very far. They insist that this question only be raised by these individuals and not by the physician. And some primary care physicians have regarded this as an intrusion into the dynamic relationship that they have with the patient and the patient's family. Often as primary care providers, they're caring not only for the patient, but may even be physician to some of the individuals involved in making a decision about the individual, or certainly to members of the family. That's not uncommon. And to suddenly have an individual whom none of them know coming in and raising this question can, to some primary care providers, seem to be intrusive, especially when hospital policy is such that those are the only individuals who should raise such questions, and they have, as it were, a right to do this, and the physician does not. So you can see that there is some potential for a certain amount of crossed interests, even though the motivation behind the existence of such agencies is very positive. Now, the thing I'd particularly like to highlight here is the description of the fact, and it's in the next paragraph and highlighted in white, that recently, as the author notes, the organ procurement agencies have adopted a strategy known as the presumptive approach for organ donation. This is not universal, but it does exist in a number of places, in a number of contexts, and that is precisely the claiming of the moral high ground that I described earlier. The approach of these individuals is that organ donation is a good thing and that you are acting charitably and helping people who might otherwise be devastated by their own emotions or not seeing clearly what a good thing it is, that the goal of the organ procurement organization is to help the individual make the right decision. Note how different this approach is from the fundamental notion of informed consent. Rather than giving the individuals all the information they need in order to make a free decision, there is the presumption here that one knows what the right decision is, and the goal is to, as it were, convince the individual to make that choice. And if you drop down to the chart, the article highlights the difference between what the author calls the standard approach and the presumptive approach. First, beginning with the introduction of the individual, instead of asking, would it be possible for this person to speak to you, the statement is, Mary is a member of our team. She is going to speak with you and answer any questions you might have. So the person is introduced as a member of the team, even though they are not actually a person involved in caring for the health of the individual. And instead of saying, I'm here to provide you with information about organ donation, the approach would be to say, I'm here to provide you the opportunity to donate your loved one's organs. So providing an opportunity, not so much information. Instead of the example here, some families choose the option of donating their loved one's organs. I'm here to help you make the decision. The approach would be, you and your husband now have the opportunity to make your son a hero through the gift of organ donation. So there would be appealing to the highest possible motives. And then rather than saying, we'll support whatever choice you make, the approach would be, most people have given the chance to save a life, will do it. Effectively, inducing guilt. It's implying that any decision other than the decision to donate organs is abnormal, is unusual, and the implication being ethically wrong. And rather than saying, if you decide to donate, the approach would be, when you decide to donate. And the last little area, the last little contrast, would you like me to give you some time before you make your final decision? Instead of that, the statement is, if you don't have any more questions, I will now guide you through this process. So one can see that this approach verges on, if does not move into, the coercive. It's clear that the representative of the organ procurement organization who adopts this approach, and not all do, but those who do, are convinced that this is the right thing to do, and their goal is to help the individual or induce the individual to make the right decision. And you can see, as highlighted in red, that if you look at this, if you step back from this, there is a big problem. The presumptive approach undermines many of the core elements of informed consent. And the author of the article says, in seeking informed consent, for example, in research, we adopt meticulous safeguards to ensure that consent is fully informed, voluntary, and free of any manipulation or coercion, even to the extent that in research one looks carefully for anything that might be pushing the individual unfairly in the direction of agreeing. Whereas, in the case of organ donation, we require that families be counseled by people whose agenda and approach are inherently conflicted. Now, the author of this article is not opposed in any sense to organ donation, but they are alarmed at an approach that philosophically seems to be so different from what one does otherwise in medicine, and that is enable people to make free and informed decisions as best they can. The guiding principle, the guiding force, the guiding pressure behind this so-called presumptive approach is, of course, the relative lack of organs and the sense that more and more people need to be encouraged to donate. And section 4 is something we will discuss as a particular subject in itself, as the next subject in this section of our course, and that's the issue of organ donation after cardiac death. That is, organ donation by individuals who are not brain dead, people who, for legitimate reasons, have decided, or it has been decided, will have life support withdrawn, and then life support is withdrawn, but not in the patient's room, but in an operating room, with a period of time after withdrawal of life support, and if the person's heart stops beating within a certain number of minutes, then the organs can be removed by the transplant team. And as we'll see, this is something that requires a very significant number of safeguards, can be the source of not only real concern, but potential and real abuse, and the necessity for very clear and specific protocols is absolutely essential. And the author of this article is pointing out that in the case of organ donation after cardiac death, there is often, if not always, the desire to begin things before patient death that will ensure that the patient's organs are, the person who's about to die's organs, are going to be as fresh as possible, as good as possible for the purpose of organ donation, which would include, for example, using heparin, a drug that would prevent blood clots, and maybe even other drugs, and in unusual protocols, if, for example, extracorporeal perfusion of organs, that is what is called a heart-lung machine in cardiac bypass procedures, is employed, then there will be catheters, that is to say, large-bore needles implanted in the arteries to provide various fluids that will prevent the organs from being damaged. And this would be done prior to the patient's heart stopping beating. And the question arises, should the family be required to give specific consent to all of these things, or the patient? If the patient is conscious and able to participate in this discussion, there are representatives of organ procurement or agencies who say that simply the individual's desire to be an organ donor should suffice, and that detailing the various protocols is not necessary. However, as we'll see, generally speaking, it's expected that whatever is to be done to the individual prior to death must be specifically consented. But as you can see, the nature of this article, and with this we're going to conclude, is to highlight the fact that the pendulum has swung, and this is the last highlighted section of the article. The pendulum has swung too far in the direction of procuring organs at the expense of commitments that are fundamental to the physician-patient relationship. And one has to watch out. The author is saying that the trend could substantially erode the public's trust in the transplantation enterprise. It is an ethically questionable thing to presume that one is on the very high moral ground and that one has the right to coerce or force or effectively use the doctor-patient relationship in order to require the person to make the right decision rather than encouraging them to do so.